January 1993. Mrs. Eddy says of the books of Genesis and the Apocalypse that they contain a deep divinity of the Bible. The purpose of this recording, made by Gordon Brown with the group of students who participated in previous recordings, is to lead thought through the first 14 chapters of the textbook to the teachings of the 15th and 16th chapters, Genesis and the Apocalypse, as this comes to the surface of consciousness out of the text's own deep divinity.
As a result of all the work, all the deep, consecrated, spiritual praying and spiritual probing which we've done together over so many years, the majority of which is currently on record, both on tape and in book form, we feel compelled now, don't we, to return to the textbook itself, knowing that this, in conjunction with the Bible, is the Redeemer, the Comforter, the Healer of ourselves, of each other, and what looks on the surface to be our present self-destroying world. And this undertaking is the natural outcome, isn't it, of the work which we've recently completed on the 7,000-year periods of the story of human civilization, which the Bible itself inevitably opened up for us. All of which, the Bible story and the civilization story, gathered itself together, didn't it, in an orderly and interwoven way on that big threefold panorama of the chart that we know as the triptych. And incidentally, it might be well to have this still open in front of us now. Prayerfully, we allowed the universal perspective of this to unfold to us from the top of the chart to the bottom, until all seven of its millennial periods, correlative with all seven of the timeless days of creation, were in the seventh and last period of all, in the words of the textbook, united in the infinite design of God. And we used as a symbol, didn't we, a roll of carpet or tapestry on which was woven a beautiful cosmic pattern or design in the form of one complete roll at the top of the chart. We followed the unrolling of this day by day, period by period, down the entire length of the triptych. And in doing so, because in the progression of the divine science of being, nothing is ever left behind, we conceived of it as rolling itself up again as we walked along it until, in the end, at the bottom of the chart, there it was, one complete roll again, just as it had been at the beginning. The difference now being that as a result of the orderly unrolling, we ourselves had glimpsed and had made our own something of the order, the beauty, the rhythmic and scientific symmetry of its great timeless, spaceless design. And having encompassed it in this way as one beautiful holistic panorama, having appreciated, that's to say, if only a little, its overall divine perspective. We found we could focus, couldn't we, on any particular part, any particular moment of the unfoldment, and evaluate this spiritually and scientifically, because we were conceiving of it in its setting within the design as a whole. In other words, what we were observing in its differentiated oneness was what we might call the conceptual interwoven logic of the Logos, or Word of God. Nothing out of context, that's to say, but every part held in indispensable relationship with every other part within the harmony of the overall design, signifying that whatever aspect of the compound idea we might be concerned with, we were finding it in and of the unity, the scientific wholeness of its divine principle, caught up unto God and to his throne, as the textbook says, safe from the ravages of the devouring great red dragon. So that, turning now to the textbook itself, must we, as has been our custom perhaps in the past, start always at the beginning of the preface and work our way forward paragraph by paragraph, chapter by chapter, until the whole book has been covered? Can we not rather take up the teaching at whatever point we feel at this moment to be spiritually and scientifically appropriate, both for ourselves and for our world? You see, through that orderly series of tape recordings which we made a long time ago, but which we are told are as fresh and valid today as when we made them, we virtually touched upon the teaching of the textbook as it unfolds in its own divine order all the way from preface to fruitage. In other words, we covered the book as a whole in the way in which its unfragmentable principle presents it to us. Bearing this in mind, therefore, why should we not start today at a particular part of the book's holistic teaching which we deem to be of crucial importance to us and to our world, instead of feeling we must always begin at the opening of the preface? Why, for example, should we not take it up at that part of the text that clearly relates with the overall meaning of the chart of the triptych that we've recently been working with and which we've therefore grown familiar with, and which, incidentally, we've put on record, haven't we, verbally on tape, and also in the recently published book That the World May Know? In other words, why should we not take up the teaching at the point of the key to the scriptures and consecrate ourselves wholeheartedly on those two terrific chapters, Genesis and the Apocalypse, which Mrs. Eddy says contain the deep divinity of the Bible? Yet we can only logically do this if first we see the two chapters in their setting within the perspective of the book as a whole. So in deciding that this is what we would like to do, let's begin with the relationship of these chapters to the chart of the triptych. in particular to those seven major columns, you've got them there, that make up the center panel. Is that a good idea? All right, then let's do that first then. Now, which is the chapter in the textbook that immediately precedes Genesis? It's the great summarizing chapter, Recapitulation, isn't it? The book's 14th chapter, based as this is on that range of capitalized synonymous terms that answer the question, what is God? But then from the very beginning of Mary Baker Eddy's mission, the written statement of her discovery had always been based, and necessarily so, if it's a science, on this most fundamental of all human questions, what is God? In fact, don't these terms pervade the textbook from cover to cover? And isn't it true that the whole of Christian Science teaching is therefore founded upon them? It most certainly is so. So looking, therefore, at the first of the seven columns, you see it there with the chart open in front of you, what do we see that it contains? It's made up, isn't it, of these very synonymous terms for the one absolute God in their fundamental divine order. In the order, that's to say, of the Logos, or Word of God, declaring in science what I, God, am. So from the 14th chapter, Recapitulation, to the 15th chapter, Genesis, then, where we find first the statement of the 7 days of God's creation, which therefore correspond to the second column, right? And secondly, the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden corresponding to the third column. So do we see the exact parallel there? After this, the fourth column right in the middle of the seven, which is so vital to us in its exemplary meaning because it unfolds the life work of Jesus. Jesus, who showed how he came forth from the Father to solve the great problem of being, corresponding therefore to the first column, and how his own life experience unfolded in consequence in accordance with the order of the 7 days of creation in the second column. And how in doing so he proved the total unreality of the mythology of Adam as we find this unfolding in the third column. How as a result he became the way-shower for all mankind, typified by the children of Israel in the Bible in the fifth column. This being the teaching symbol for the progression of the civilization movement itself in the sixth column. The underlying divine determinant of which is the orderly unfoldment of the holy four-square city, or of civilization, as its divine principle knows it and controls it in the seventh and last of the columns. the human society that is of the Word, the Christ, Christianity, and science. And so here with the City Foursquare, we find ourselves, don't we, in the very heart of the second of our two chapters, the Apocalypse. And this second range of capitalized terms standing for the diversity of all things in unity, we name the four, don't we? Just as we name the contents of the first column, what God Himself is as infinite mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, love, the seven. So that the panorama as a whole is held secure between these two enveloping outermost columns representing what God is and how God operates cosmically, eternally. Now, can we acknowledge, therefore, that the overall emphasis with the chapter Genesis, deriving as it does from the 7 days of creation, is on the divine seven, while that of the Apocalypse with its descending four-square city is on the four? And not only that, but regarding the two imperative messianic advents, which when spiritually understood dominate and determine the entire human story, can we see that the chapter Genesis has the emphasis on the manhood aspect of the world-saving Son of God that appears as the mission of Christ Jesus, while in the case of the Apocalypse, the emphasis is on the womanhood aspect of the same Son of God that appears as the mission of Mary Baker Eddy, the discoverer and founder of Christian Science? And one more thing before we leave the question of these spiritual parallels, can we see regarding the two textbooks themselves that the chapter Genesis has an overall relationship with the Bible and the chapter the Apocalypse with science and health? Because we certainly shall see this when we reach the end of the Apocalypse and find that the great ministering shepherd, the 23rd Psalm, stands for these two books in their God-determined, impersonal unity, whereby the human race need no longer want. We don't want, because at this stage of things, we subjectively are. We subjectively have. And the problem of material objectivity, limitation, time, and mortality is represented, therefore, as solved. So just as it was essential to encompass the triptych from beginning to end in order properly to evaluate any particular part of it, so it's essential now for us to appreciate the Spirit of God unfolding without a break from prayer to recapitulation before turning our attention to Genesis and the Apocalypse as they open the key to the Scriptures. Agreed. So let's begin, shall we, to follow the miracle of the order of these first 14 chapters as they prepare us to embark on the consummate goal of the last four chapters. That we all have a copy of the textbook handy. Then let's open it first at that introductory flyleaf where we find those three short initial quotations. We got that? Because the whole proposition before us, isn't it, is to know the truth. That is to let truth, capital T, reveal to us in science its own infinitude as truth, little t, in order to deliver us humanly from the trammels of mythological error. And the process we see is wholly a mental one, taking place at the point of our own individual thinking, for as Shakespeare says there's nothing either good or bad but thinking. Thinking makes it so. And what in consequence we realize is that God isn't really going to hear our prayers and as a result bless us sometime in the future, because in truth, in science, thou hast already heard my prayer, therefore I am already blessed. So that what I'm actually experiencing at this moment here and now is thy high behest. Thou here and everywhere. All right then, let's turn over to the contents page. And what's the first thing we notice there? That the book is in two distinct parts, isn't it? The first part after the preface, consisting of the first 14 chapters from prayer to recapitulation, and the second part, called Key to the Scriptures, being made up of the four final chapters, Genesis, the Apocalypse, Glossary, Fruitage. Themselves so clearly, aren't they, in an order corresponding to the four sides of the Holy City, the Word, Christ, Christianity, science. Yes, no doubt about that, is there? So let's agree never to forget those reassuring words of Mrs. Eddy, where she tells us that science and health with key to the Scriptures is none other than the voice of your Father speaking to you from cover to cover. That's to say, it is the voice of the incorporeal, divine, supreme, infinite mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, love, teaching us what God is in science, and therefore what we man are, as this very idea of God. And doing it by voicing to us his word in the textbook's own irrefutable order and logic. And again, let's not forget another of those remarkable statements she makes regarding Christian Science textbook, namely, and this is in Miscellaneous Writings 3725, that the textbook of Christian Science is transforming the universe. Now, isn't that an extraordinary claim to make with reference to a book? How can it possibly be so? Well, let's try to reason it through. Because we know, don't we, that it was at the beginning of the 20th century, in the year 1902, that the order and relationship of the science and health chapters were arranged in their final form, that is, in the matrix-like, womb-like structure of the four-square mother city. that this stood for the divine reality that lay behind the teaching symbol of Mrs. Eddy's mother church. Remember, therefore, how it was in 1891 that she included a treatise of this Holy Mother City in the chapter The Apocalypse for the first time. Also that in 1892, the year following, she resurrected the church organization which she herself had dissolved in 1889 and called it specifically the Mother Church. In other words, the church's divine reality, already part now of the Apocalypse chapter, preceded by 1 year the appearing of its own temporal organizational symbol. Yet it was not until 1902 that she so changed and finalized the order of the chapters in the book as to make the book as a whole conform to the pattern and structure of the Holy Mother City itself. Is that right? At which stage it was the Christian Science textbook, therefore, elucidating the timeless expression of the Word of God that represented and taught the orderly content of God's very universe, pointing therefore to the universe's translation from the apparent language of matter, physical science, materialistic philosophy, and so on, back into the language of spirit. And therefore it could be said that the textbook of Christian Science is indeed transforming the universe. Transforming the mortal space-time sense of the universe, that is, by bringing to light its divine reality, or the way in which the divine principle itself sees it and knows it. You like that? Well, here we are then with the book still open at the contents page, where the 18 chapters in their basically four square matrix form are preceded, aren't they, by a preliminary preface. Now, a preface is, as we know, to the text that follows it, as a prelude or an overture is in music to a symphony or an opera or some other musical score. It contains, in other words, a kind of preview of what is to come. And you will notice that those two musical terms, prelude and overture, occur early on in the chapter Genesis when we get to it later on. Now, I don't know whether you've ever heard the following story. But in the years subsequent to Mrs. Eddy's founding of Christian Science in World Consciousness, when John Dawley was researching deeply into the textbook for what he knew must be the living, comprehensible science of her revelation, that he kept coming across references to the word system. For example, the system that I denominated Christian Science, or the very well-known one, Divine Metaphysics, is now reduced to a system, to a form comprehensible by and adapted to the thought of the age in which we live. And he realized that he didn't know in just what scientific way this word system was being employed. Now it happened. One of his pupils at that time, a lady who was a musician, an opera singer in fact, decided to give up her musical career and devote her life to the understanding and practice of Christian Science. Accordingly, so we are told, because the textbook teems with musical terminology as a means of teaching through symbols the divine science of life, she started to extract and list all the many technological musical terms until she began to glean from them, apparently, a sense of musical order, structure, and system. Anyway, she showed her findings to John Dawley, and as she explained them to him, he said, "This is just what I've been looking for. Now I can appreciate scientifically Mrs. Eddy's use in the textbook of the term system." So in due course, what is meant by the divinely metaphysical system of Christian Science began to unfold and consolidate in his thought, taking the form eventually of what we know today as the seven of what God himself is as infinite mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, love, and the way in which this idea of God functions cosmically as the four of the Holy Mother City of the Word Christ, Christianity, Science. Together, of course, with those four outstanding ways in which throughout the textbook the term science is used. Science by itself, divine science, absolute Christian Science, and Christian Science, the way in which these terms are also employed. Well, we can accept, can't we, as we look at the contents page, that what we have in the order of the chapters is first of all seven chapters, followed by a further seven, and leading to the final four chapters that comprise the key to the scriptures. Right? And I was so glad the other day to have a musician assure us that however far music evolves from what is called classical music into the realm of so-called modern music, technically, music itself will always be traceable back to its musical roots in what is known as the diatonic scale. The scale, that is, which is fundamental to all the different musical keys on which music itself is based. And what this diatonic scale consists of is, first of all, the seven notes of whatever the particular key is that's being employed, as these lead to the sounding of the eighth note of the scale called the octave. The purpose of this eighth note being to resolve and to fulfill the order and signification of the scale itself. So why don't we just go over now to the keyboard of the piano and see if we can hear, symbolically of course, something of the order and meaning of these 18 textbook chapters with which at the moment we are concerned. Shall we try that? All right. Off we go then. Well, here we are then with the keyboard in front of us, and we start, shall we, by playing the lovely open tone of middle C. And we'll stay with the key of C major, though the same scale with the same tonal intervals and values applies, of course, in the case of all the other major keys. So this then is the diatonic scale of C major. But if I were to play the same scale in the key, say, of what? F sharp major, it would sound like this. You can hear the same intervals, yet what a difference in tone, isn't it? And do you hear how the eighth note, the octave, so beautifully fulfills the order of the first seven notes? And therefore, if the first note called the tonic is C major, middle C that is, the eighth note, the octave, is simply C again, played an octave higher, isn't it? We see that, or rather we hear that, don't we? Well, let's see what happens if we relate the scale, purely symbolically, of course, with the order of the chapters of Science and Health. It would be like this, wouldn't it? First note C, first chapter, prayer. Second note D, second chapter, atonement and Eucharist. Third note E, third chapter, marriage. Fourth note F, fourth chapter, Christian Science versus Spiritualism. Fifth note G, fifth chapter, Animal Magnetism Unmasked. Sixth note A, sixth chapter, Science, Theology, Medicine. Seventh note B, and the seventh chapter, Physiology. Now this seventh note of the scale is called the leading note because it leads the ear to hear the scale's fulfillment in its own eighth note, the octave, which is C again. The same note as the tonic, but now played, as we said, an octave higher. And correspondingly, the eighth chapter is Footsteps of Truth, isn't it? Or that which seems to gather into a single chapter the spiritual import of the first seven footsteps of the textbook, or the signification of the first seven chapters. That's the eighth note, the octave, and the eighth chapter, Footsteps of Truth. So with that eighth note becoming now the tonic of a second scale, let's continue with the relationship of the ensuing chapters with this new scale. To repeat then, the eighth note, which is C again, relates thus with the eighth chapter, Footsteps of Truth. while the ninth note, D again, relates with the ninth chapter, creation, because at this point an entirely new, completely limitless sense of creation presents itself. Then we have the tenth note, E again, parallel with the tenth chapter, science of being. The 11th note, F again, parallel with the 11th chapter, some objections answered. The 12th note, G again, parallel with the 12th chapter, Christian Science Practice. The 13th note, A again, parallel with the 13th chapter, Teaching Christian Science. And the 14th note, B again, parallel with the 14th chapter, Recapitulation. At which point, the door opens, doesn't it, to the key to the scriptures, and therefore to the four remaining chapters of the book. Now here's something which is surely most significant symbolically. For once the first seven notes of the scale have led to the scale's fulfillment in the sounding of the eighth note, the octave, we're in a position not only to sound the eighth note itself, but to sound also what is called the common chord of that particular key. And lo and behold, this common chord consists of precisely four notes. The first, third, fifth and eighth notes of the original scale. Listen therefore to how the seventh note leads not only to the eighth, but much more beautifully and much more impressively to the sounding simultaneously of the fourfold common chord. Let's play it. Isn't that lovely? You see, it's almost like bringing heaven down to earth. You can feel that if you stopped at the seventh note, you need the fulfillment of the chord itself to make it all real, practical, demonstrable, provable, something like that, if you're thinking of it in divine metaphysics. Do we see that? And in terms of the chapters, what we have left then with those four that make up the key to the scriptures, Genesis, the Apocalypse, Glossary, Fruitage, the 15th, 16th, 17th and 18th chapters, meaning that in terms of the common chord, Genesis, the 15th chapter, has got a relationship with Footsteps of Truth, the tonic of the second scale, the Apocalypse, the 16th chapter, a relationship with Science of Being, the third note of this second scale, Glossary, 17th chapter, a relationship with Christian Science Practice, the fifth note of this second scale, while Fruitage, the 18th and last chapter, relates with the simultaneity of the chord as a whole. Well, let's quietly think about that, shall we? First, Genesis in relation to Footsteps of Truth. Well, don't the 7 days of Genesis correspond to the very footsteps whereby truth conducts us step by step forward in that orderly sevenfold way? Surely they do. And the apocalypse in relation to science of being, well, think of how science of being culminates in those 32 sections of the Christian Science platform, 4 groups of 8 sections each, stressing respectively the 4 sides of the holy city of the Word, Christ, Christianity, science. Now compare this with the way in which the Apocalypse chapter is itself rooted in the descending 4-square holy city. It is, isn't it? Agreed? Then glossary in relation to Christian Science practice. Well, isn't it true that the purpose of Christian Science practice is to heal every aspect of the human experience by translating it out of the language of unreality matter into the language of reality spirit? And isn't the purpose of the glossary, said on page 579, to be the metaphysical interpretation of Bible terms, giving their spiritual sense, which is also their original meaning? See the parallel? Well, lastly then, the 18th chapter, fruitage, the 4th and last note of the Common Core, pointing to the spontaneous healing purpose of the textbook as a whole. Now, can we possibly begin to appreciate, therefore, this quite remarkable musical analogy, showing symbolically, only symbolically of course, a relationship between the notes of the diatonic scale on the piano and the sequence of the textbook's 18 chapters. I don't make more of it than you want to, but it's there as a symbol, if you should find it helpful and useful to think about. All right then. Let's go back now to where we were before we came to the keyboard, and that is to the textbook, Science and Health, at the point of the preface. This being the introductory prelude to the whole of the ensuing colossal unfoldment. Back to the preface then. So here we are then, back again. And what we expect to find in a preface is, as we've said, a foretaste of the ideas that are to follow throughout the book itself. So would it surprise you to find that the preface of Science and Health is made up of precise 19 paragraphs, the same as the number of chapters in the book, plus the preface itself. So shall we see if any such foretaste is really discernible? Not so much in terms of literary comparisons, of course, though in certain instances even this is clearly the case, but more in terms of what in the paragraphs themselves we might call a spiritual hint, perhaps, of the subject of the chapters that are to follow. See what I'm trying to say? So let's have the book open then, shall we, at the preface's opening page, and at the same time keep in the forefront of thought the titles of the actual chapters. Yes? Well, first then, paragraph one in relation to chapter one. Now, don't you feel that when you are imbibing the teaching of that heavenly first chapter prayer, that you are indeed a wakeful shepherd, in fact, a prophet shepherd beholding the first faint morning beams ere cometh the full radiance of a risen day? As we find this stated in the preface's opening paragraph. It really is so, isn't it? In the second paragraph in relation to the second chapter, the thinking of the life work of Jesus as portrayed in Atonement and Eucharist, what we surely see, don't we, is truth independent of doctrines and time-honored systems knocking at the portal of humanity. Also the fact that Jesus must know God aright. That's line 19. Or he couldn't possibly demonstrate life eternal in the way he does, and as this second paragraph puts it. So at least the hint of a parallel, isn't there? And after that, paragraph 3 in relation to chapter 3. The point of paragraph 3 and the third chapter, marriage, we actually begin to put into life practice, don't we, what we're beginning to understand of Christian Science, or where in fact we're being sturdy pioneers hewing the tall oak and cutting the rough granite. Don't you think so? Anyway, another hint, isn't it? Then paragraph 4 in relation to chapter 4. And this is where in paragraph 4 Mrs. Eddy tells us how her system has been fully tested and has not been found wanting. That's page 8, lines 1 and 2. Well, do you know what it is in the Bible that has been weighed in the balances and has been found wanting? It's the superstitious beliefs and practices of the king of Babylon in the book of Daniel, isn't it? That which is not found wanting is thus the healing system of Christian Science, while that which is found wanting is Babylonian spiritualism, astrology, necromancy, and so on. Hence the chapter, Christian Science versus Spiritualism. Parallel with this fourth paragraph. Well, on then to paragraph 5 and chapter 5. Well, certainly the truth, which is spirit in this paragraph, unmasks the animal magnetism involved in material theology and physics. Even as Noah's flood, referred to at the end of the paragraph, destroys the violence and corruptions of the flesh on the face of all the earth. So is there perhaps just a faint touch of the fifth chapter here in this fifth paragraph? But in paragraph 6, in relation to chapter 6, the correlation is immediately, literally self-evident. In the year 1866, I discovered the Christ Science and named my discovery Christian Science, Mrs. Eddy says on the opening page of Science, Theology, Medicine. While here in paragraph 6 of the preface, she recounts in almost exactly the same words how, in the year 1866, she was led to the discovery of the system that she denominated Christian Science. So in this case, the parallel is quite unmistakable, isn't it? The paragraph 7 and chapter 7, then. Now, on the opening page of the 7th chapter, you remember how it says how physiology closes the eyes of mortals to man's God-given dominion over all the earth. Whereas here in the preface's 7th paragraph, we're told how a child drinks in the outward world through his eyes and rejoices in the draught. But what basically is the outward world which he drinks in through his eyes but the world of physiology? It is so, isn't it? Well, on then to paragraph 8 and chapter 8. And here Mrs. Eddy tells us how her early essays were but feeble attempts to state the principle and practice of Christian Science. Yet these early footsteps led her, as a willing disciple, she says, to the heavenly gate where she is still waiting for the mind of Christ. And we remember, don't we, how the 8th chapter, Footsteps of Truth, leads us, at its close, to the Horeb height where God is revealed, and where therefore we hear God himself declaring, I am that I am. Remember. Hence this is where we too are waiting for the same mind of Christ, aren't we? Then paragraph 9 in relation to chapter 9, which is where we learn how science must be demonstrated by healing before a work on this subject can be profitably studied. How different, therefore, from what we read at the beginning of the 9th chapter, Creation, regarding the mythical human theories of creation that spring from cultured scholars in Rome and in Greece, and which afford no foundation for accurate views of creation by the divine mind. In the one case, a demonstrable living science at work, in the other, just mythical theories and human beliefs. Yes? All right, to paragraph 10 then in chapter 10, where we have the first reference in the preface to Science and Health itself, which is certainly the textbook of the universal science of being, the subject of the 10th chapter. Also, we might say that the platform of infallible divine metaphysics, which we find at the end of the chapter, gives the supreme answer to what the paragraph itself calls the stupendous life problem. Isn't it so? Perhaps then, just the hint of a parallel. And now comparing the 11th paragraph with chapter 11, you see what the human mind objects to above all else is that it is not a healing agent, is in fact not even a factor at all in the principle of Christian Science. Hence what it does in retaliation is to put forth incorrect theories, plagiarisms of science and health in order to maintain itself in opposition to Christian Science. Hence the 11th chapter answers the world's objections to what the world truly is in and as Christian Science itself. After which, in paragraph 12, in relation to chapter 12, the parallel is again self-evident. The chapter is Christian Science Practice, and what we read in this particular paragraph that corresponds to it is that through, quote, the thousands of well-authenticated cases of healing, Mrs. Eddy and her students have proved, through their practice of Christian Science, the worth of her teaching. So here again, the correlation is immediately apparent, isn't it? And so to paragraph 13, relative to chapter 13, where we are told that no intellectual proficiency is requisite in the learner, but how sound morals are most desirable. And this is precisely the theme of teaching Christian Science, the 13th chapter, where this same demand for morals and ethics is said actually to be God's requirements, his requirements, that is, regarding the teaching of Christian Science. So yet another self-evident parallel, don't you agree? After that, then, to paragraph 14, corresponding to chapter 14. Well, doesn't the 14th chapter recapitulation, with its precept upon precept, line upon line, here a little and there a little, rationally explain, in the words of the 14th paragraph, how faith in the workings of the fleshly mind must yield to the workings of spirit itself, and therefore, of course, to the workings of absolute Christian Science, said to pervade the statements of this 14th chapter. Perhaps no more than a hint again, but there it is, isn't it? So to paragraph 15, in relation to chapter 15. And what's the main theme of Genesis, the 15th chapter? Isn't it that the darkness of the Adam dream of mortality shall give place to the light of the seven immortal days of creation, just as we find this intimated in the preface's 15th paragraph? In other words, in the physical healing of Christian Science, sin and disease lose their reality in human consciousness and disappear as naturally and as necessarily as darkness gives place to light and sin to reformation. So again, there a quite literal parallel. Then to paragraph 16, in relation to the 16th chapter. And in this tiny little three-line paragraph, again, the parallel is beautifully self-evident. For doesn't the Apocalypse, the 16th chapter itself, tell the story as nowhere else in the textbook it's told, of how God called the author to proclaim his gospel to this age and charged her at the same time to plant and water his vineyard? So the parallel there is really quite wonderful, quite beautiful, isn't it? There I see we're nearly at the end of this first side of the first tape. So what we'll do is to pause there, turn the tape over, and continue on the second side.